From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near Eastridge.
Sunset.
Eastside, San Francisco.
Border of Venus.
San Jose.
Coming up, we'll conclude our series on Asian American mental health and discover why providing mental health care for Cambodian refugees might mean rethinking psychiatry itself.
We don't have a whole lot of terminology for mental health. It's a new field to us because of the war.
Then we meet the head of the state's largest medical cannabis dispensary, Steve DeAngelo.
I've never known when I come to work in the morning whether I'm going to go home at night or whether I'm going to be taken away in handcuffs.
And we'll hear a preview of San Francisco's Stern Grove Music Festival. That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. For the past several weeks, KALW's Erica Mu has been bringing us stories about mental health and the Asian American communities. Erica is with us now to introduce the final story in her series. But first, Erica, why don't you give us a quick recap of what we've learned so far?
Sure. So the main takeaway from the series thus far is that many people in the Asian American community who need help aren't seeking treatment. And if they end up ever getting it, it's often when their problems are more severe. Even people who do end up getting care, they don't stay on their treatment plan. So there's a major difficulty in making care accessible to this particular population. And when I say population, remember, it's referring to more than 50 subgroups. And this lumping together is precisely what masks some serious problems that are happening only to particular groups like Asian American women, for example.
And that was the topic of your last story, through two women with similar issues you explored, a really troubling statistic.
Right, right. So one major study found that Asian American teenage girls and seniors register higher rates of depression. And unfortunately, a CDC report found that these same groups have higher rates of suicide as well.
So what other trends do you see when you look more closely at groups that fall under this big term of Asian American?
Well, Southeast Asians in particular have higher rates of depression as well than, say, Chinese immigrants. And we're really talking about more recent immigrants who may have come here as refugees. I interviewed Stanford University psychiatrist Dr. Darren Richeter, and he told me there's one group in particular he's been working with.
Cambodian refugees having PTSD, it's so much higher than what you would see in any other population that it's remarkable.
So Richeter says that figuring out how to treat Cambodian refugees has meant rethinking the way we understand psychiatry and healing. And that's what my final story is about.
And that story takes us to San Jose, and we'll go there with our own Erica Mu.
To find the Unify Event Center in San Jose, you have to weave your way through a huge parking lot, swing around the Walmart, and follow the music into a large banquet hall. Today is Khmer or Cambodian New Year. There are about 100 people in the hall right now, sitting around large circular tables while the house band warms up for the evening's party. It's a small crowd, but this is a small community. There's an estimated 12,000 Cambodians in the Bay Area. Khmer New Year is a positive reminder of their roots and homeland, despite the fact that so many came here under such traumatic circumstances. In the early 1970s, Cambodia was in the middle of a brutal civil war. Eventually, the communist Khmer Rouge, led by Pol Pot, seized power, and its reign was characterized by horrifying sites of massacre, known today as the Killing Fields.
I don't have any sibling right now. I don't have any brother, sister. I don't have any nephew, any niece. No, nothing. They killed the whole family.
That's Sopani Bay. She lives in San Jose now, but in April 1975, she was living alone with her three small children in Phnom Penh. That's when Khmer soldiers entered the city. She remembers the morning when the evacuation began.
The April in Cambodia is so hot, very hot, you know. I took my children to stay under the mango tree. The way that we go, we don't know where we go, you know. They just go, 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 but we don't know. They use a gun. Go, 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 go. They use a gun like that.
Bay is describing soldiers forcing her and her family out of her home. Over the course of many grueling months, Bay would watch each of her children die of malnutrition and disease as she worked in the concentration camps. She thinks about them every day and dreams about the terror at night.
I never dream about my life in the United States. Always dream back to Pol Pot regime. So like people try to kill me, try to cut me or something like that. Bad dream. And the other people like me also. They have bad dream. They have nightmare.
Most of the clients that we see that have PTSD will have pretty severe sleep disorders where they have a good deal of insomnia.
That's Dr. Darren Richarder from Stanford University. He works with victims of political violence. He's also a psychiatrist for the Cambodian program at Gardner Mental Health Clinic in San Jose. He's been at Gardner for about 8 years, but things were different when he began.
So the psychiatrist's major function in this clinic when I joined it was simply to write prescriptions for antidepressants and sometimes antipsychotics.
Nevertheless, at the time, the Cambodian program was groundbreaking. There were Cambodian case managers and clinicians who spoke Khmer and guided group therapy sessions. Sopani Bay is one of the counselors, and she says her background helps others open up.
I trust them. They trust me also. When they complain about nightmare, I believe, because I have nightmare also.
A lot of our clients don't speak the language, don't speak English.
Bhopal Penn is also a case manager at Gardner. He says that there are more difficulties than just the language barrier when dealing with the community.
They don't read, they don't write, so there's a lot of paperwork that you need to fill out before you can see a doctor.
Over 90% of Cambodian Americans speak a language other than English in the home. About half have less than a high school education. So it's no surprise that the median income for Cambodian families is among the lowest of the Asian subgroups, at just over $35,000 a year. It's for those reasons, Penn says, that his clients have had trouble paying for and learning American systems, from insurance to public transportation.
Most of them don't drive. Most of them need to be picked up and then drop off. And that's what we arrange, so that there's a taxi picking them up and then dropping them off when they need to be seen here.
Gardner Mental Health provides help navigating Social Security, insurance, and legal issues. Penn himself makes house calls, along with Bay, but he says they're still dealing with a serious culture gap.
We don't have a whole lot of terminologies for mental health. It's a new field to us because of the war. During the killing field, all scientific research or information were destroyed. I mean, there was no such thing. Books were burned during the killing field, so nothing was left.
But as much as the Cambodian population in America has had trouble understanding psychiatry, Western psychiatry has had trouble understanding Cambodians. Again, Dr. Richarder.
When I started practicing here, probably 80 to 90% of the medication clients that were seen here were on antipsychotic medications, medications used to treat disorders like schizophrenia, when they did not have schizophrenia or anything like it.
Richarder says doctors were confused when Cambodian patients would come in and complain about a ghost sitting on their chests. It happened a lot. Sopani Bay describes the feeling.
When I take a nap, during daytime, sometimes, it seems like it's something on my chest, heavy, too heavy, I try to wake up, but I cannot. Too heavy, sit on my chest.
If you came into any psychiatrist's office with that complaint and you started with that, and the psychiatrist will say, well, what is this person talking about? Is this person psychotic? Or is this person having, serious nightmares at night wherein, that's the experience of the nightmare?
For Cambodian patients, a ghost sitting on your chest is the best way to describe what they're feeling. Richarder says the best translation is sleep paralysis with hypnagogic hallucination, fancy language for the motor system shutting down during dream sleep, leaving you temporarily paralyzed. But simply understanding this sleep phenomenon doesn't necessarily move the conversation forward.
If you explain that back to a Cambodian person, even our case managers, if you say, well, you know, no, you're not being visited by a ghost. What's really happening with you is this appreciated, understood Western phenomena that we call sleep paralysis. They don't accept that at all. They'll say, no, I'm being visited by a ghost at night. You know, almost like you're not listening to me. You're not hearing what I'm saying.
After many of these kinds of conversations, the clinic decided to bring in a different kind of expert. Again, Bhopal Pen.
We brought in a monk. The monk have established their role as a healer. We, a mental health counselor, have not established that role yet in our community.
Dr. Richarder got the idea when he was visiting Cambodia a few years ago, observing how mental health groups were caring for survivors there. He found that in Cambodia, providers addressed mental health needs in spiritual terms.
All of them were linked to the temples in one way or another. And oftentimes they were sort of working in concert with the temples or working with the monks.
So Gardner now invites a monk to lead a meditation session in the clinic with the help of one of the Cambodian counselors. The program helps bridge the gap between Western psychiatry and Eastern spirituality. On a recent morning, Dr. Richarder walks me down a narrow hall until we reach a closed wooden door.
So they're here, you can tell.
He's referring to the row of shoes that are lined up outside.
Let me just interrupt them, and I'll ask Sopani to come out. Oh, there she is.
Oh, yes. Hi.
Sopani Bay is leading the meditation this morning. She's filling in for the monk who usually leads the session. Inside the small room, there are about five or six people sitting on the floor. Bay is reviewing lessons from previous sessions. Don't steal, don't kill. And then the meditation session begins.
Okay, we start. Right now we start.
For the next half hour or so, everyone sits quietly in a circle. One person falls asleep. Bay says that's okay. The point is to get people out of their houses and better connected with mental health services, if they're open to it.
Life is a struggle. You have to struggle to live in the United States.
These sessions have been going on for about 3 years now, and when asked whether they've been effective, Dr. Richarder hesitates before he gives a firm answer.
Well, this is probably the part you're going to want to edit out, but I'm not sure. I mean, honestly, we've tried to capture that to the extent to which we've had a measurable impact. And, you know, much of the material that we've actually tried to record has demonstrated, like, this impact that's unrealistically good.
He says the likelihood of a complete turnaround for this community in just a couple years is low. Really low. The surveys have improved, but Richarder and his colleagues are still figuring out the right questions to ask. Still, the Cambodian program looks to be going in a good direction.
We are serving over 90 clients. We're having about 5 Cambodian speaking staff. We've grown so fast.
And Richarder says that's important for everyone in the Bay Area, not just Cambodians.
You know, the Cambodian population in San Jose is a very marginalized and very complicated population, and this is our American community.
Back at the Unify Event Center in San Jose, you can almost see two different experiences of the celebration. The younger generation was born here, far from what their parents suffered under the Pol Pot regime. They're here to dance and connect with neighborhood friends. But for their parents, this is an important day to remember where they came from. It's a part of their home that they're still happy to have with them. In San Jose, I'm Erica Mu for Cross Currents.
Erica Mu has been reporting on Asian American mental health as part of the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships. That's a program of the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. You can visit our website to hear the first two stories in Erica's series. We're online at kalw.org. Again, that's kalw.org. And if you or a loved one needs support, you can visit our website for a list of organizations who can help you find treatment. We're at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Marijuana is legal for medical use under California law, but sale and possession are still federal crimes. Raids on growers and dispensaries and a general climate of uncertainty are increasingly creating problems for the industry. Last week, the company that processes most dispensary credit card transactions nationally announced that starting in July, it would no longer do so. That means businesses will now have to conduct most of their transactions in cash. Here in the Bay Area, downtown Oakland is such a noted center of cannabis activism that a section of the city is known as Oaksterdam. Yet Oakland's largest dispensary is a few miles away from downtown on the Embarcadero. Harborside Health Center claims to be the largest such club in the state with over 100,000 members. The center was the subject of a short-lived reality series called Weed Wars. It focused on the day-to-day activities at Harborside. These ain't your local D-boys. These are the brothers that be fighting the weed wars. At the center of Harborside's activities is Steve D'Angelo, a longtime marijuana activist and outspoken critic of federal policy. KALW's Stephen Short offers this profile of a major player in California's medical cannabis industry.
Hey, Jeremy, how's things going in the nursery?
Everything's going great, Steve. Our supply is up. Everybody is ramped up and ready to go. I don't think we're going to have any supply issues this year.
The slogan of Harborside Health Center is "Out of the shadows, into the light." It's a philosophy that Executive Director Steve D'Angelo takes seriously. He says he got the idea from his building designer. She suggested he put windows in the sales area, something he had never seen in a dispensary.
I sort of had a double take, and I was like, why not do that? I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not ashamed of what I'm doing.
And he never has been. D'Angelo has been a marijuana activist since he was just 16 years old. He helped plan the first hemp museum. He organized a traveling hemp tour. And he worked with author Jack Herrera in the publication of his book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. This book is still cited by pro-hemp and pro-marijuana groups over a quarter of a century after its publication.
I always knew that I wanted to be an activist for social justice.
These are not idle words. D'Angelo has been an activist since he was a boy.
In 1971, at the height of the Vietnam War, I organized an occupation of our junior high school gymnasium. And we held that gymnasium for a whole day and I think made a very effective statement about the war.
Lessons from such early activities stayed with him and helped lead to his life's work.
I found that many of the other issues that are dear to my heart, like democracy, individual liberty, compassion, equality of health care, all are impacted by cannabis activism.
While living in his hometown of Washington, D.C., D'Angelo was deeply involved in the 1998 political campaign to legalize medical cannabis there. The initiative passed, but was overturned by the U.S. Congress. By this time, California's first medical marijuana law was already in place, so he decided to, shall we say, move to greener pastures. He co-founded Harborside Health Center after receiving a cannabis dispensary license from the city of Oakland in the fall of 2006. Earlier this year, the FBI raided Oakland's Oaksterdam University and forced a number of dispensaries throughout the state to close. That may have been surprising to some, but not to Steve D'Angelo.
The very first day that we opened our doors here at Harborside, there were DEA agents raiding medical cannabis locations in San Francisco and in Oakland. And we opened our doors that day. Since then, I've never known when I come to work in the morning whether I'm going to go home at night or whether I'm going to be taken away in handcuffs.
Harborside's location could keep it off the DEA's radar. It's not near parks or schools or residential areas. Furthermore, it's operating within the city of Oakland's guidelines for cannabis dispensaries, as well as state regulations. While Harborside has yet to butt heads with the DEA, they are fighting tax claims from the IRS. That agency says the dispensary owes millions in back taxes. Harborside contends that they wrote off legitimate business expenses, such as payroll and health care costs. But the IRS says that's not legal, because Harborside is selling illegal drugs, which it is, under federal laws. One of the main concerns behind federal crackdowns nationally is what officials might call the migration of cannabis from medical use, which is regulated in several states, into recreational use, which is not. Many activists are working towards getting recreational cannabis legalized, but D'Angelo thinks that's misguided. He doesn't even accept the idea of recreational cannabis. The plant, he says, is neutral. What varies is how people use it.
I believe that cannabis can help inspire people to make creations, which can be part of a recreational activity. But it's not the cannabis itself which is recreational. The cannabis is playing a wellness function, which enhances or enables recreation.
Now, wait a minute. I have to ask you about that. I mean, the typical stereotype of somebody who's been smoking or eating marijuana, their response to that would be, what? You know, it's supposed to slow you down. You're drugged now. So that's the opposite of what you just said.
Some people believe that cannabis just makes you spacey and that you wouldn't be able to create anything when you were using cannabis. But if you go back and look in history, you find that remarkable artists from Louis Armstrong to the great Sufi poets of the 7th century all speak about how cannabis has inspired them, has enabled them to take the stage and give tremendous performances. So, in fact, cannabis is really a great aid to creativity. That's why musicians, writers, painters, and performers have always loved cannabis.
Like many advocates, D'Angelo can cite a long list of positive aspects of cannabis, including this one.
One of the well-known benefits of cannabis amongst regular users is that it tends to promote forgiveness and understanding. And so cannabis can be a powerful tool to conflict resolution in anything from business disputes to lovers' quarrels.
This forgiving attitude will no doubt prove useful to Steve D'Angelo as the legal wrangling associated with his industry continues. In Oakland, I'm Stephen Short for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. That story was reported by KALW's Stephen Short, our designated cannabis correspondent, and he's here with me in studio now to discuss some of the recent developments in California's marijuana industry, and there's been a lot going on lately, Stephen. So what about that mention at the start of your profile of Steve D'Angelo that said that dispensaries can't use credit cards after this weekend?
Well, this is a big surprise. The company is called Electronic Merchant Systems, and they are the main credit card processor for medical marijuana dispensaries nationally. Now, unannounced, unbeknownst to them, 2 weeks ago, these dispensaries got an email from EMS saying, quote, effective July 1st, medical marijuana merchants will no longer be able to accept Visa or MasterCard credit or debit cards. However, they can continue to accept Discover.
That's very odd. So what do you think is happening here? Are they afraid of a federal crackdown or something?
Well, it could well be. I mean, I called EMS a couple of times, but they did not respond. So this is what happens in this industry. People don't give you information, and then you have to just make things up. But
not that you're making anything up here. Let's
well, no, but what I mean is if you don't get real information, then you have to speculate, or there are rumors moving around, and that's about all we have. Now, this story was broken by the online Medical Marijuana Business Daily, and they have some contacts who have said that it seems that the credit card companies themselves, Visa and MasterCard, have then pressured EMS to do this action. which of course leads you to think, who's pressuring Visa and MasterCard?
Right, because it's obviously a lucrative business. There's a lot of transactions that are happening. So this now says that mainly it's got to be cash. What kind of impact do you foresee on the on these businesses?
Well, I went to one and called another of the local dispensaries, and it's a big deal. One place in particular said that at least half of their business is credit card. You can imagine this can be an expensive purchase when you go into these places, and people don't want to carry around cash. They like the convenience of a credit card. So there are possibilities. You could either they can either maybe come up with debit cards, or naturally there's going to be another possibility of a card processing. But that's all unknown at this point.
All right. So what else is going on in cannabis news this week?
Well, there were a couple of other big things. On Monday, a state Senate committee was supposed to vote on whether to create the first Board of Medical Marijuana Enforcement. This was to establish a statewide regulation for this industry.
Right, because that's been one of the complaints, is that it's not regulated.
Well, it's not regulated consistently. Cities and counties have their own rules. For example, Fresno says no dispensaries at all in Fresno. Well, they can do that. But San Francisco, of course, has several. But there's no oversight over the whole state. Now, this was sponsored by Tom Amiano of San Francisco. It made it out of the assembly to go to the Senate, which was a big deal in itself. That has never happened before. But the Senate committee that was studying it, when they looked at it, they said, well, it needed some more work.
And so they pulled it off the agenda. Why?
Well, there were various reasons, but I think the short answer is Amiano didn't have enough votes. He was quoted as saying, I couldn't count enough noses.
And that's KALW's cannabis correspondent, Stephen Short. If you'd like to let us know how you feel about the marijuana industry, you can give us a call at our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. You can just leave us a message about the new laws at 415-264-7106. You can also connect with us on Facebook. We're KALW News. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Chris Hoff, Nina Ginsler-Debs, RTM's Kunahoffs, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Isaac Silk, Taja Lanier, Audrey Dilling, Lupe Hernandez, Lisa Ratner, Erica Moo, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Green Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Our executive editor is Ben Trefney. And thanks to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. Yes, you. We are listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll take a closer look at an impending prohibition that's got California in a frenzy.
It's tasty, and it's something that helps connect you to our heritage. Foie gras is a 5,000-year-old ingredient, something the Egyptians figured out 5,000 years ago. And it's part of what we think is that it's a shame to just throw that away on a moment's notice.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The 75th season of San Francisco's Stern Grove Festival is underway, and this Sunday's show should have the audience on its feet. The opening act is feel-good San Francisco band The Stone Foxes, who you're hearing now. They'll be followed by the legendary Preservation Hall Jazz Band from New Orleans. Tickets are, well, tickets aren't necessary. Just show up. Music begins about 2 p.m., and parking is nearly impossible. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. It's hot as hell.